Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
A couple of bad things.
I'm sorry about that. What are they?
My cousin, who's the only actor in our family, died last night.
Oh, that is bad.
At the age of 102.
Well, that's kind of good.
He had a long, long life. He was in all the Frank Capra movies. He was the mayor in The Music Man.
Mayor in The Music Man died.
Charles Lane.
So this is
very nice man.
So this obituary probably appeared in places.
No, I don't think it's happened. I just heard from my mother. I don't think the obituary has appeared.
But they will.
But he has an incredible list of credits. But they will. Yeah, he was an important character actor.
To what do you attribute his longevity?
Genes, I assume.
Okay.
Genes that I probably don't share. He was my grandmother's cousin. I don't know what that makes him to me. But he was a wonderful raconteur, and he had a lead in a movie called 20th Century with John Barrymore. That was his, I think, biggest part. But
wow.
He was always the face in the crowd. He's in It's a Wonderful Life.
What did he play in It's a Wonderful Life?
He's Evil Man Potter's assistant. He delivers an important speech about how you can't let the Jimmy Stewarts of the world run free because then people will resist Potter's evil schemes.
Yeah, I think I can envision him hovered over Potter's desk next to Potter.
Yeah, I think he's next to Potter.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought he's the guy who brings in the scale model of Pottersville. But anyway, he had a long and fruitful life and was a lovely man, but there you go.
Well, 102's not bad.
No.
If somebody offers me that deal right now, I'll sign on the dotted line. Was he in reasonably good shape till the end?
I think so. Yeah, he just passed away quietly in his sleep, as far as I know. But he got a little grouchy toward the end, I think.
Gee, I can't imagine that in the Kaus family.
And also, I discovered that this file cabinet behind me, I opened it up and it has mold in it. So that's not going to be there next time you see me.
Well, fortunately, you're not the kind to be concerned about things like that, right?
I am concerned, and that's why I am very sympathetic to the argument that it was lead abatement that led to the decrease in crime, and Kevin Drum's points about how lead abatement could in Pakistan could lead to a decline in terrorism. Any microbial analysis or pollutant-based analysis, I'm very sympathetic to. Because I'm sensitive to those things myself, so why shouldn't Muslim extremists be sensitive to those things?
You're a bacterial determinist.
Well, in this case, it isn't bacteria.
Viral determinist. Microbial determinist. You had it right the first time.
Particle-oriented. I'm a nanodeterminist.
Okay. Well, it all does get down to the nano level eventually, causality.
Okay. But the good thing is that we have a sex scandal in Los Angeles.
Excellent.
The mayor's been caught cheating, and we're gossiping like it's New York.
Yeah, you know, I saw that, and I know you're upset about that, right?
I'm not upset. I like gossip, and I...
You wish him to harvest political ill for this mistake, right? We should tell people. Your mayor, whose name is what? It's a compound Hispanic name.
His name's Tony Villar, and he changed it to Villa Raygosa when he married Raygosa.
Yes, and the ill-fated wife, who's now in the process of being divorced or something, because of his love interest...
Well, first, I don't think you bounce politicians because they cheat on their wives. So
yeah.
I don't think he's going to get bounced. And second, he was doing some very good things as mayor, and I hope he still does good things. The problem with the scandal is people are realizing he hasn't really accomplished any of them. He's trying to take political accountability for the school board, which is good, you know, Bloomberg style. It's quite hard to do, but he won some elections where he put his people on the board, so he's sort of responsible, and he's carved out a little area of the city that they gave him control over, and he pushes Green Dot charter schools, which is good. So all those are good things. He just hasn't really made major advances, and he wants to build mass transit to the sea and to the end of the valley, which we desperately need, as people are realizing. So everybody hopes he does those things. So, no, I think he's just not that smart, and people just don't, you know, people realizing is there or there or there. That's the problem.
Well, also, people are saying that this means he he can't be governor. Some are saying that, but it sounds like there was reason to think he would never get that high anyway. In your analysis,
no, there's reasonable to think he would get that high and then not accomplish much. So the good thing about it is that people are gossiping about politicians, despite the L.A. Times' wet blanket approach to it. I mean, they admit that it's not a question of, you know, blogs versus mainstream media getting it accurate. The L.A. Times admitted that they knew that the previous mayor, Mayor Han, his wife had left him, and they only mentioned it in one paragraph, buried in a story once. Mm-hmm. They gave him a pass on it, and it affected his job performance. And he was going home to take care of the kids at 5, and not being able to do his work. Yet they covered it up. So they will cover up things that they know are true, and they've done it for years, and now they've lost control of the process, that the blogs and the reporters are all... Don't work for the L.A. Times.
Well, not reporting something is not exactly the same as covering it up, I'd say, in the way we use that term.
Well, they admit they gave him a pass. What does that mean? It means they didn't cover it up. They didn't gossip about it, even though they knew it was true, the way they did among themselves.
Yeah, well, you agree that there are some lines, there are some things you don't report about, right?
Right, but when the mayor of New York, Giuliani, got divorced, it was front page news for days.
Yeah, eerie parallels here with Giuliani. I mean, it's an anchor woman is, again, the woman who tempted him away from his wife, right?
Sorry?
As in the Giuliani case, we have here with the L.A. mayor, it's a TV anchor woman who lured him away from his wife.
No, in Giuliani's case, his wife was a TV anchor woman.
But wasn't she wife number two?
Well, right, but then wife number three came along.
Well, right, but at one time she had been the temptress.
Well, but the first wife number one was I don't know how the transition from wife number one to number two for Giuliani
I'm
went.
I'm pretty sure the answer is unsmoothly, but anyway.
But wife number one was his cousin, right? So.
Really?
Yeah, so he was in the service of genetic mixing.
Giuliani's got a lot of problems then.
The point is that all this Giuliani stuff is public, and L.A. has never been public before. Now we're becoming more like New York, and it's a good thing.
Congratulations.
Well, Villaraigosa may be the innocent victim of this transition. But
The only difference is that in this case, the anchor woman is from Telemundo.
But we think he's moved on from the anchor woman at Telemundo.
Really? She's not even it anymore?
No, you got to read the blog
to find
out what's happening. He's moved on to a bunch of other babes, we think.
Okay.
The one theory is that the anchor woman from Telemundo is the one who dropped the dime on him.
Ooh.
So, there. But she's quite something.
To me, the anchor woman looked just like his first wife, except 10 years younger.
Yeah, that too.
Okay. But meanwhile, in Iraq, there's a war going on.
Yes.
I guess Bush is looking like he's losing support among Republicans. A number of senators have been saying markedly less supportive things lately. And the White House is going to give Congress this report, which is kind of a foreshadowing of the September benchmarks report. And I gather that in this report they will kind of concede that a lot of the benchmarks for September are not going to get met. These are by and large... Iraqi political benchmarks, things they were hoping that the government would accomplish.
Right, and it's not even that Tom Ricks article in the Washington Post points out that it's not even clear that the benchmarks are relevant anymore. One question is, suppose they passed the benchmarks, suppose they had an oil revenue sharing agreement, would that really contribute to security on the ground? I'm not so sure.
Well, it would raise the prospects for an eventually unified Iraq. I think something like that is a prerequisite for a unified Iraq in the long run.
Well, it's a prerequisite for a partitioned Iraq. I mean...
Well, right. There we get at the old issue that this administration, you know, for a long time was not seriously facing the possibility that maybe the best outcome at this point, or the least bad outcome, is a partition.
I mean, the Sunnis would be much happier with partition if they were guaranteed a share of oil royalties, so...
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by partition. I mean, if you mean individual sovereign states, that ain't going to happen. If you mean, loose confederacy.
I mean a loose confederacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
go ahead. It does... Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I insist.
It does seem to me there's a rush to withdraw, and Congress is getting perilously close to a veto-proof majority for some sort of withdrawal. An election year rushed to withdraw heedless of the moral consequences. And you know, I was happy to have an election year rush with immigration because it produced a result I like, and immigration was much simpler. A no-bill solution, just an abject retreat, was actually a pretty good solution. Here, an abject retreat is probably not a good solution on the key word is
well, I think using the adjective abject kind of loads the analysis, preloads the analysis, Mickey.
Okay, I meant
abject things are never the most hoped for outcome.
Having one extreme, you know, result was fine with immigration. The result was no action at all so far. There's sort of three positions. There's total withdrawal. There's which the New York Times came out in favor of, which would mean we don't get to do the good things we're doing in Anbar. But yet we completely remove any reason for sort of people to be in Iraq to react against an American presence there. The middle ground, which is sort of Iraq study group, withdraw to strategic bases, let the civil war rage on, but somehow intervene to stop al-Qaeda spreading. I don't quite know how that happens, but presumably that means that whatever good we're doing in Anbar keeps on happening. And the third is sort of the muddle through on the president's surge course, where we engage in a counterinsurgency strategy, where we actually go and hold, put our troops out in the community and try to hold those communities.
And is your sense that Defense Secretary Robert Gates is actually opting for the second of those?
Well, that's what everybody says, but the issue to me is why. Why don't we opt for the third, but instead of directing the surge at maintaining a unitary government, which really does seem to be a lost cause at this point, if it ever was the right cause, why not direct the surge toward setting the grounds for partition? That seems to be the obvious solution. He was supposed to be gravitating toward that solution a couple of weeks ago, I think the last time we talked. Why isn't that the obvious right thing to do?
I don't know, but I think he knows more than we do about what's actually happening on the ground. So if he's moving in that direction, probably suggests that the indices they do have on the surge are not all that sunny.
Well, but even Juan Cole admits the surge has done two things. First, it's reduced the level of sectarian killings in Baghdad itself, although not the level of car bombs. And second, it's in Anbar, it was clear that the prerequisite for the tribes turning against al-Qaeda was our troops going in there and taking the offensive against military offensive against al-Qaeda. The idea that we can withdraw at a strategic basis and still have that go on is insane. So it has had these two good effects. Now you can say that doesn't solve the civil war, that if the Sunnis take firm control of Sunni areas, they could still attack the Shiites. All that's true. But you can't have the New York Times position of total withdrawal and then expect al-Qaeda not to make a comeback in Sunni areas, I don't think.
Well, it depends on what area. You mean Baghdad?
No, I mean Anbar.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean the Sunnis themselves have turned on al-Qaeda. I would think, that suggests that they can handle it with kind of remote support from us in the long run.
Well, eventually, but not if we, but I don't think right now. And the only reason it happened is because, we prosecuted a war. We sent in more troops. Sure, eventually, maybe.
Now maybe. I mean, if you give them the weapons, then there you get to the other question of whether, then are you just arming one side in a civil war and so on. But in a future civil war.
Al-Qaeda is very, very, very vicious. And the general's consensus is that when you leave a power vacuum, the most vicious people win. There's this one anecdote that...
Well, wait a second. I mean, when you leave a power vacuum, some people who tend to be at a disadvantage are people who are not really the indigenous force. Now, al-Qaeda has... It was originally an external force, al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was run by a Jordanian. They have since recruited some native Iraqis, but by and large, they are an alien force. That's a huge disadvantage to operate at.
Okay. They successfully operated with it for a long time.
Well, but the tide has turned. in Anbar at least.
Anyway, this is interesting because we're seeing, I mean,
it's just interesting the way touting success in Anbar can be used to make the case for moving toward withdrawal.
It can, and they were doing that this week with George Stephanopoulos, saying, oh, we can withdraw and continue our work in Anbar. Well, I don't see how we can do it right now if we totally withdraw. But yes,
I still think long run where we're heading, as I think you do, is toward partition, and the big political question and argument will be, do you leave American troops in Kurdistan, or do you withdraw them, the land-based troops, altogether and settle for, you know, a sea-based, you know, so-called offshore balancing, I guess, is the technical term when you just have a bunch of aircraft carriers.
Before we get there, the situation now is that we have a limited amount of, you know, if you read the Tom Ricks article, we had a limited amount of time before we basically, the troop rotations mean we can't maintain these troop levels next March. We're going to do as much as we can in that limited amount of time. Are we going to devote, assuming Congress doesn't cut Bush off, are we going to devote that to trying to maintain a unitary government, or are we going to devote that to trying to set things up so that when we inevitably leave, things are as peaceful as possible? The question is whether Bush can make that difficult choice, and we have to reach that before we decide whether we keep troops in Kurdistan. That's a post-partition question.
Because the point of the troops in Kurdistan wouldn't be to maintain order elsewhere. It would be for long-term American strategic objectives.
Right. So I guess I don't see that alternative getting as much play as I'd hoped. It's all this...
Well, what alternative, though? Isn't that kind of the Gates alternative, what you're describing?
Well, who knows what the Gates alternative... No, I think the Gates alternative is some sort of weird... The Iraq Study Group rejected partition. If you remember, the Iraq Study Group is somehow withdraw to strategic bases and somehow exercise power from, you know, afar to keep al-Qaeda in check. I don't know how you exercise power from afar. It's never seemed to work unless you have, like, a strong central government that you can just bomb the hell out of like we did in Bosnia, in Serbia. It's a reversion to the pre-surge tactic of hunkering down, withdrawing to bases, and training the Iraqi troops and letting them fight, you know, each other out in Baghdad without intervening. As you know, somebody brought up Srebrenica. I mean, we're going to be standing by like the Dutch troops in Srebrenica while people get slaughtered, and I don't think that's a very...
Where are they going to get slaughtered? In Baghdad?
Yes.
My impression was Baghdad at this point has been pretty clearly divided ethnically, and there really aren't a lot of Sunni strongholds left.
Well, it's 20% Sunni, so that's a lot of people in it.
Yeah, but it could change a lot in, say, 6 months. Nobody's talking about pulling troops out in 3 months, you know.
They're not?
Well, nobody's serious. That's not really on the table. What, all American troops gone in 3 months, Mickey?
I think Richardson says he pulls them out in a day. I mean, doesn't Richardson... Richardson is for total withdrawal very, very quickly, he says.
Well, that's now, not serious. That's not on the actual menu
him.
Of options.
Nobody believes him, but that's what he says.
I don't know. The other thing I'd say is it's just a chaotic system. No one has a clear idea of what's going to happen. And there's no reason for great confidence that any given strategy will lead to any particular outcome, it seems to me. We've been wrong all along.
But... It does seem that the surge has produced some good results. The failure has been that Maliki hasn't taken political advantage of it.
Yeah, look, I think when American troops move in and force, it makes a difference. But I think one thing Gates realizes is that if you ask how many troops would it take to really do this comprehensively, how long would they have to stay, that's just not politically realistic.
Right.
And the other thing is, I actually saw some numbers a few days ago, I don't know if I'll be able to retrieve them, suggesting that actually the number of bodies found has actually been going up for the last couple of months.
I know Juan Cole in a post today said no. So
said no on that particular variable?
Yes, he said it's gone from 80 or 90 a day to 20 or 30 a day. Bodies found on the streets of Baghdad.
Well, if you go from last fall to now, it is still a net a net drop. But according to this article, what had happened was it had actually started dropping before the surge, continued into the early spring, and now has been rising. And so it went from something like over 1,000 last fall before the surge to something like 500 per month or something.
But basically, the basic problem is people on the left seem to think that dead Iraqis don't count if you can blame them on Bush. That was the undercurrent of the New York Times editorial. Yeah, sure, there might be genocide, the results if we leave, but, you know, that's Bush should have gotten us in the war in the first place, which is true, but, the dead Iraqis will still be dead Iraqis, so it seems to me we have a moral obligation to have as few dead Iraqis as possible, especially since, unlike in Bosnia, we started the damn thing.
Well, I think there are serious people of goodwill who increasingly are saying, honestly, we do not know which scenario will lead to the fewest dead Iraqis. That's what I mean when I say it's a chaotic
system. You could argue that there'll just be a short period of violence followed by stability. I agree.
There's all these variables we have not even seen really at play. Like, you know, the Saudis and the Iranians, okay? If we weren't there at all, a lot of it would be up to them. So what's going to happen? Well, both of them have an interest in a kind of stability, actually. But on the other hand, they're both wary of one another, and they would fight it with it would become a kind of proxy war at some level.
Well, proxy wars could be deadly and brutal and bloody. And they can be,
and they can also lead to a stable agreement before terribly long. That's what I mean. We don't know.
I understand, but the Times didn't make the argument that it might be short and
Mickey,
and
the assumption that
stability.
If we tried an orderly withdrawal over over a year or 18 months or whatever, which is the kind of thing the Times is embracing, the assumption that that would lead to a massacre is no less facile than the assumption that you're making, which is that everything will be if we stay, everything will be okay.
I don't think I'm not assuming that if we stay, everything will be okay. If we're there to tamp down violence and the ambassador and the leader of the government say if we leave there'll be greater violence, it doesn't seem to me it's a facile assumption to assume that if we leave there'll be greater violence. Even the people who say there'll be stability in the long run admit there'll be greater violence at first. The question is how long it will last. And it seems to me morally you have to make a reasonable judgment as to what the consequences would be. You can't just say, oh, it's all Bush's fault and our goal is only to protect American lives, John Murtha style and the style of the New York Times, and leave. I mean, that's not, it seems to be morally flawed reasoning. That's my point. And it could go on for decades. Somalia, they're fighting a proxy war, and they're, you know, it's still going on after we intervene in the transition between Bush and Clinton.
Yeah. Well, you never know, but I will say that you just failed to catch a completely nonsensical sentence I uttered, and God bless you.
I just let those go by.
Yeah, no, it made no sense whatsoever. Never mind. But the point is that it's not a given that a kind of serious attempt at an orderly withdrawal would lead to genocide any more than it's a given that if we pulled out, everything would be okay. I don't think I said it that way, right? I think I failed to say it that way. That's my final closing point. We should move
that's
on.
That's a better
I think.
Point. Well, there's. Can I bring up? There are three interesting things that are happening in Iraq.
Okay.
First, it's possible that Maliki will be deposed. That there'll be a parliamentary vote of no confidence. There are people organizing against it. There's some indication that we gave our blessing to this. Who knows whether that will happen? But that could be a wild card here. Bizarrely, Al-Qaeda has now threatened to attack Iran if Iran doesn't stop making trouble intervening on behalf of the Shiites.
Why is that so bizarre? I mean, Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia long ago opted for a Sunni versus Shiite strategy.
Well, but it means that we have common ground with Al-Qaeda in checking the power of Iran. It just makes for a very strange bedfellow situation. A
lot of those in Iran.
And the third thing is, Juan Cole sort of raises the possibility, I think it's him, or one of the people he links to, that this oil law, which is supposed to be the big political achievement that the Maliki government hasn't achieved, actually we screwed it up by it's too differential to foreign oil companies. So there's actually legitimate grounds for opposing it. And basically, if you read Juan Cole, everybody hates this law. It's a little like the immigration bill, and there's not particular reason to think it's going to pass anytime soon, and they may hate it for good reasons as well as bad reasons. It may not just be the Shiites want all the money. It might be that it sees too much control of foreign oil companies.
Okay.
That's all. Those are my 3 points.
So we're going to talk about this, the latest angle in this British, this essentially foiled British terror plot is that one of the participants was an engineer.
Yeah, that was scary. You linked to this article in the New York Times about one of them. He designed airplane wings.
Your reaction, that was scary, is in my view the most dangerous reaction of all, okay? The New York Times, I think it's from the Times, the lead paragraph is, Kafil Ahmed, the engineer identified police as one of the two main suspects in the British car bomb plot, worked for much of last year as an aeronautical engineer for an Indian outsourcing company that designs aircraft parts for Boeing, Airbus, and other manufacturers. And you had the reaction I would worry about, which is, oh gosh, next time I get on an airplane, who knows?
Why is that, why does one worry about that reaction?
Well, because first of all, I think if you look at the way, like, things like airplanes get built, you know, there's nothing like a mid-level engineer can do that would have the effect that a terrorist might want, you know. In other words, nothing goes wrong during the testing of the plane. I mean, first of all, there's the empirical fact that no planes have fallen out of the sky lately for inexplicable reasons. I think it's very, very hard.
Why is it wrong to worry about it? A lot of these things depend on software. You can bury things in software so that on Yasser Arafat's birthday, everything goes haywire, and it's hard to detect. I mean, why is that it's a movie scenario, but why is that not a realistic worry?
I just think when you look at the way these companies are structured and the way the testing and supervision works, it's probably pretty unlikely that this could happen. I would also just say, if you worry about it, it's what the terrorists want is what I mean. I mean, I would compare it to the other piece of scare news of this sort that came out, which was that a lot of these guys were in the British medical establishment. Now, if Brits, every time they go to a hospital and see a doctor of South Asian descent, if they start going, I don't want to deal with this guy, then the terrorists have won that round. That's what it is to inflict terror on a population, is to get them to start having these irrational fears. And I would put this in that category.
Why isn't that a rational fear? That's like saying we want men to stop being attracted to women. If Muslims blow up a bunch of places, people are going to be scared of Muslims for a while. That's just human nature. You can't fight that, Bob.
If I thought that men being attracted to women stood a good chance of kind of accelerating a kind of unfolding potential clash of civilizations and making it a self-fulfilling prophecy the way I think this does, I would say let's do fight our sexual impulses, okay? It would be worth it.
Well,
you're right that the kind of paranoia that different people exhibit to different degrees, and I think you would agree you are more prone to than some, perhaps, is in a sense a part of human nature. It's a kind of natural reaction. What I'm telling you is a big part of the war on terror should be fighting those temptations, and because they are exactly the kind of thing that make it all a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'll give you, here is a prophecy I'll give you about what I fear is likely to happen in America. Is, look, sooner or later, one of these homegrown terrorist plots is going to succeed to some extent.
Right.
It's going to kill 2 people or 20 or maybe even 200. This is all assuming it doesn't have some kind of massive, you know, very sophisticated sponsorship that could lead to something horrific, but still succeed on some scale. Now, I fear that what's likely is the reaction we will have is exactly the kind of reaction that will make it that kind of thing only more likely to happen again. And I suspect people like you, Mickey. I mean, you've in the past said you're in favor of ethnic profiling at airports, right?
What's the reaction that you fear? It's going to be like the Siege, we're going to round up all Muslims in concentration camps?
Not
what do you think is going to happen?
No, not going that far, but small steps in that direction, in the sense that the systematic exercise of suspicion of Muslims in a way that antagonizes Muslims and makes them more likely to become terrorists while doing very little to actually, you know, reduce the chances of short-term terrorism. I
agree that one should fight that impulse, but I would say that profiling of pastors entering airplanes has a huge effect on fighting short-term terrorism, so there it's worth it.
Well, so you think there should be a kind of ethnic profiling that's not being done now?
I don't know quite what's being done now. I know that the Israelis, who have the most effective system, profile like crazy.
No, I mean in America. Are you in favor of something, you know, a real out-and-out ethnic profiling?
I think I'd be happy with a hypocritical system where we said we weren't ethnic profiling and we did. It seems to me we do already. So, I mean, certainly passengers do. So it just seems to me that's inevitable and it's probably cost-effective in the short run, yes.
Well, I mean,
this is one of the ways that I'm a horrible, horrible conservative.
Yeah, it is, but a horrible, horrible paranoid. I mean, look, Mickey, you know, the premise of that we need ethnic profiling, is that we have a really serious radical Muslim problem in America. And it is empirically the case that we just don't, because it would be so easy for any reasonably skilled Muslim radical in America who had a couple of like-minded friends to kill an appreciable number of people that the fact that it hasn't happened at all, you know, for 6 years now, since 9/11, suggests that we just don't have a problem. I'm sorry. Now,
if we had the English problem, you'd agree that profiling was okay?
Well, I don't know, but they have a bigger problem than we do, and I would probably argue against it even then. But what I'm saying is the kind of thing...
You're always making these arguments, and then you don't hew to the logical consequence, which is if we had a different situation, you'd behave differently, and you find some other excuse. We should, you know...
Oh, look, you can set up a thought experiment, you know, where we know that a Muslim has an atomic bomb, you know, and we know, and there are 12 of them in the room, and one of them has it. I mean, you can set up a thought experiment where I would say, yes, do something like ethnic profiling. I'm saying we are nowhere near the point in America where that's a rational response, and it will make things worse. And...
You're saying if we have two lines, one of which you're given a mild frisk, the other of which you're given a medium frisk, and if we put Muslim males through the medium frisk line and old grandmothers through the mild frisk line, that this is an outrageous assault on Muslim dignity and will cause a lot of terror.
It has nothing to do with whether I think it's an outrageous assault on dignity. I'm saying anyone who understands human nature will say that it's a predictable effect of that, Mickey, to really piss off a lot of young Muslim males. You don't think so? You don't think so?
I do think it will piss off some.
Oh, and is that a good thing right now?
It's worth it, no, but I think it's probably worth it in the short run. There are ways to disguise it.
So you're in favor. Wait, let me get clear. You're in favor of separate lines at airports. Muslims here, non-Muslims there.
No, there already are separate lines at airports, Bob. There's a super screening line and a weak line. I always get shifted into the super screening line because I give off a bad vibe that the agent at the gate.
Well, wait, I thought
detect.
You just said it would be okay to have two lines, one for Muslims with more thorough frisking.
No, I'm saying there are two lines, one of which is the extra scrutiny and the other of which is the mild scrutiny. We have that now.
And you want to channel Muslims systematically into the one?
Along with all the other people we challenge into the one. Yeah, if we
channel... So you want to have like a one
channel,
line that's like 70% Muslims and another line that's like no percent Muslims.
They're not going to be 70% Muslims. There are not that many Muslims around. It's going to be, it's going to be, you know, 10%. It's going to be 3%.
Mickey, the percentage
Muslims.
Has nothing to do with the absolute number in this case. You know. I mean, then it'll be a short line, maybe.
It's not going to be 70% Muslims. It goes. I think it's about 5-1 now, and 20% Muslims are not going to take up an appreciable portion
of
the
20%. You're advocating a system
line.
Where it would be obvious to everyone that, yes, Muslims are being singled out. And... You know, you're doing that to address a problem that manifestly does not exist, okay? Because, as I just said, you know, there's been plenty of opportunity for Muslims to kill people over the last 5 years.
So you say
they don't do it.
Well,
so you're addressing a risk that fundamentally is at a very, very, very low level. You're doing it with a policy that you concede would piss off a lot of young Muslim males, and you concede that the anger in that particular population is a real contributor to terrorism. And look, I just don't. I totally cannot
Muslim
comprehend
males,
your argument.
Young Muslim males will get pissed off, as do many African Americans when people look at them funny. You know, people, African Americans who shop in Brentwood resent the fact that the store clerks, you know, seem to be watching their every move.
And Muslims get that too, but that's not a question of government policy, Mickey. We can't change that.
Right. The question is, does the incremental attempt, the incremental amount of hatred created by shunting Muslim males, and you can shunt all males if you want, all young males into the extra scrutiny line, does that contribute more to hatred than it does provide security? And you could convince me that I'm wrong.
Already said doesn't convince you, I don't know what it would take. Just look at
but
evidence.
Let's not do pastors aboard airplanes. Let's do airplane engineers, which is the topic that started this discussion. You're saying, oh, don't give any extra scrutiny to Muslims from Pakistan who may want jobs at Boeing, you know, because they might get mad. The Muslim airline engineers might get mad.
I'd say that would be a real downside of that. Yes, it isn't just the engineers. No, I mean, Muslims in general would resent that.
It seems that seems to be a harder case because you're dealing with such a small number of people in such a sensitive area. You know, anything in anybody's past that causes suspicion in some sensitive areas should prompt extra scrutiny. And when you're designing airplane wings, that's probably one of them. Maybe we shouldn't outsource the building of our airliners to Infotech in Bangalore.
Well, that is the kind of response I would predict that you would have had. I would be in favor, if it came down to it, if it was a serious threat, I would rather pay a little more to have just more elaborate review of airline engineering, you know, within Boeing or something. I think that would, in terms of, you know, cost effectiveness and preventing terror,
effect,
that would be better.
Because it makes it more, that would have exactly the same effect, Bob, because it would make it more less economical to ship it to Bangalore in the first place if you had to have an elaborate review, which means that fewer jobs for Bangalore, which is exactly the same effect as if you didn't give them the work in the first place.
Well, no, but the review, it could be an extra layer of review that doesn't change who you're outsourcing it to. But in any event, it wouldn't have the downside of antagonizing Muslims.
This is, you know, an example of where you think I'm much more conservative than I am. And I basically buy the Kevin Drum war on terror strategy, which is the same as your war on terror strategy, which is all our efforts should be directed at making the Muslim world as inhospitable to terrorists as possible.
Not quite all our efforts, but a lot. Yes, that should be the heart of the campaign, I think.
And I agree with that. We're dealing on whether the application of that principle, what it requires.
Well, okay, but you realize some of the policies that you are advocating here would be a great boon to those in Muslim countries that want to stir up hatred of America. You realize that, right? You can't have it both ways.
I agree with
Kevin Drum.
I don't think agitators in Pakistan going around saying we have to strike at the great Satan because they profile airline passengers in America. They say we have to strike at the great Satan because he's killing Muslims in Iraq, and because he supports Israel, the little Satan.
They would love a picture of seven Muslims standing in one airport line and a bunch of non-Muslims in another. They would definitely put that on the air,
that
Mickey.
That picture's not going to happen. You know that.
What?
They're going to be two Muslims and 20 people like me in an airport line.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're
I wasn't annoyed that I got extra scrutiny in the airport line. But.
Well, no, because you didn't think it was on account of your ethnicity. It's a different kind of feeling when somebody singles you out on the account of your ethnicity. I'm flattered when somebody considers me threatening. It's great.
I used to be singled out on the basis of long hair. But it may have just been the general sense of paranoia people got looking into my eyes, so.
Yeah, well, anyway, I mean, I really do mean, one thing I'm serious about is, When some sort of small-scale homegrown terrorism inevitably enjoys some success in America, it would really be nice if we had a president who was good at, who first of all resisted the natural impulse to exploit the opportunity to increase his or her authority.
Well, Bush
did a good job of calming everyone down and putting it in perspective.
But Bush has totally resisted the impulse to profile. I mean, he kept Norman Mineta as the Secretary of Transportation who resisted profiling. He constantly gave, joint appearances with suspect Muslim clerics who claimed to represent the responsible portions of the Islamic community. I mean, that was his first reaction.
Well, resisting profiling is good. He's not in all respects, obviously, resisted the impulse to, amass power within the executive branch.
You're saying that Muslims inherently resent massing power in the executive branch?
No, I'm saying that's just a separate problem. It's gratuitous.
Bush has been
authority
very good.
Is not a good thing.
Bush has been good by your experience. You just can't bring yourself to say that. By your standard,
in that one case, yes.
In general, name a situation where he's exploited anti-Muslim sentiment. Yes.
Well, he's done things that have made it worse. He's just
different.
Using terms like Islamo-fascist, which he quit doing after somebody pointed out how stupid it was. I think. Guantanamo. Saying, look, yeah, America likes the idea of due process, but for these Muslims that we suspect, sorry, that's the way it plays in the world. That's bad. So, no, he's not been a universal success by my lights, I'm afraid.
Yeah, okay, but
he's in some ways responded better by my lights than, say, you might if you were president. That's true.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Now, are we going to segue into the surveillance question?
Well, there is this surveillance question of the Brits have video cameras everywhere, and people. I think Senator Lieberman has proposed to copy that in the United States, and I think there's a plan to do that in Manhattan. I would have thought that you would approve of this, since you've always been fairly firm on the need to sacrifice privacy to stop terrorism in an age where weapons of mass destruction are increasingly
available to small numbers of people. That's not my big shtick. I mean, my big shtick
was
is...
Was your big shtick in your book Non-Zero?
Well, no. The analytical point in that I'm proudest of in this context, I mean, this came out shortly before 9/11, was saying, we traditionally think of this inexorable trade-off between civil liberty on the one hand and security on the other. In this age where, kind of hatred can morph into terrorism, can morph into massive lethality, there's actually a third variable, which is how many people in the world intensely hate other people. To the extent you can reduce that, then you can get increases in security without commensurate sacrifices of civil liberty.
But
that was the message I was preaching.
In other words, you said we have to sacrifice some privacy.
Oh, I think, we will inevitably, and yes, to some extent, but that's...
Why isn't this some of the ability to be spotted by a video camera on public streets, in public, why isn't that one of the first bits of privacy?
As sacrifices go, that's far from the worst, I think.
Right.
Because when you're in public, you think, well, I'm in public. You're not thinking it's private. On the other hand, there are safeguards I'd like to see. Very careful who has access to the video, what's finally done with it. And in the case of, there is this one article in today's paper about this Manhattan system they're setting up in South Manhattan, which will go beyond videotaping per se for purposes of kind of retroactive security use. It's going to be very systematic recording of license plate numbers by video. And, for example, there's going to be alarms will be set off internally within the police system when the license plates of suspect vehicles enter Manhattan. Now, one thing I would like to know is, what is your criterion for a suspect vehicle? And also an interesting question to me is, should those criteria be transparent? Should it be public? What is the definition of a suspect vehicle? I mean, if I, in a moment of anger on Blogging Heads TV, say that Bush is an idiot, and he should be killed, half of which is definitely defensible, by the way. Is that one of the criteria? I'd like to know that kind of thing. Do you think the criteria should be transparent?
These seem to be completely second-order considerations. They have to look at the license plates. First, and police departments all over the country look at the license plates now. I was followed the other day by a cop cruising slowly. He hung around behind me for about a minute. He was running my license plate.
So yeah, but that's against
that
a database of known violators of the law. I don't think that's what this is.
Second, they have to run the license plates anyway if they're going to have congestion pricing the way they do in London. They're going to send you a bill for being in Lower Manhattan. So they run the license plates anyway. Why shouldn't they also run the license plates against some terrorist list? And why should they disclose the criteria? But, you know, this all seems to be relatively trivial concerns. You basically are on board with the system.
Well, no, the point I would make is, as I understand it, we're not talking about the standard police database where they run the license plate to see if this person's been picked up for DWI or has a weapons charge or blah, blah, blah. I assume that these are going to be, somewhat less kind of binary criteria. They should be, right? If they're going to try to hunt down people who could well be terrorists,
right,
because many of them have not committed crimes. I mean, you would agree with that. And my question is, well,
what's your problem?
What?
So what's your problem?
Well, my
they
problem
can't
is
make it public because
my problem is that those kind of criteria will inevitably get into things like who has said what on what website. And I'm just saying, I am sufficiently suspicious of authority as exercised when you do not have the antiseptic value of sunlight, of transparency. That I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I don't want the criteria to be a little bit transparent. I'd like to, as a taxpayer, I'd like some degree of specificity.
It seems to me that's a judgment call, but clearly, the Secret Service checks on anybody who makes a threat against the president. And if you make a threat against the president and drive with your license plate to Southern Manhattan, where the president is, I would hope you would get extra scrutiny. Yeah. I agree it's susceptible to abuse, and it could lead to some sort of chain of suspicion where somebody who's completely innocent gets gunned down in a hail of police bullets because they're so paranoid. But, that seems pretty remote.
Well, I should stress, just to stay out of the database, that when I said half of that was arguably defensible that I said about Bush, I was talking about the idiot part, not the he should be killed part.
Wouldn't save you if you were Ann Coulter. She got taken out of context in exactly that sense.
What'd she say? The Edwards thing?
Yes. She said, I suppose, to be safe, Bill Maher got away with saying that Vice President Cheney should be assassinated, although he didn't say that, but she thought he did. So I guess, to be safe, I should say that John Edwards should be assassinated. She didn't say John Edwards should be assassinated. She said it in exactly the same context that you did, which is, a hypothetical. And yet people just quoted the part about being assassinated the same way they could just quote the part where you said that about Bush. So,
well, I would like to see the complete tape.
You and Ann in solidarity again.
Once again.
Every time you announce a conservative principle, like we should kill Osama bin Laden, or of course we should sacrifice some privacy, when it gets down to particulars, you always back off to please the graduate students who are hanging around you or something.
Actually, I was the one who started out by asserting that, of course, we should infringe privacy. You were making that assertion and attributing it to me. I didn't. That wasn't my opening salvo.
It's in your book. You want me to go back and find the passage in your book where you say that?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's not there, but it's totally not the upshot. It's not the overriding emphasis at all.
Yep.
I mean, I depict it as probably kind of an inevitability, yes. But it's not I'm not kind of trying to draw America's attention to the need for this. If anything, I'm saying, look, that's going to happen. The question is how we minimize it.
I thought you were embracing it, if not enthusiastically, as a
necessary
I think
you were reading your
deal.
Own agenda into mine to some extent.
Well, we'll go to the book.
Go to the video book.
Okay.
Speaking of video, you have some provocative thoughts about YouTube?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was an article by somebody named Gabby Wood, who I don't know if it's a man or a woman, in The Guardian, on this theme of the YouTube election. And when that first came out, I think the first time I read about it was John Dickerson writing about it in Slate. I poo-pooed it on the grounds that, well, YouTube videos, they can catch candidates in macaca moments, and, you know, where they say something stupid and publicize it, so they can do that. And they can make little videos that keep the troops happy. But I doubted that you could actually make videos that are seen by enough voters to affect an election, and people seeing the video and saying, oh, I like that candidate, or oh, I don't like that candidate. I do think that that is changing now, that it is possible, you know, the most obvious candidate is the one this British writer talks about, which is the Obama ad where they're throwing the parody of the Apple ad where they smash the image of Hillary. I mean, that was seen by millions and millions of people. It's possible that if a homemade ad goes viral, that it can actually directly affect millions of voters now. And that has all sorts of interesting consequences.
First, it
means that the process of electing might be sort of much more chaotic, and sort of it's an ecology of what goes viral and what doesn't, and out of the control of the candidates. Second, it has important implications for campaign finance reform. First, because, you know, one of the attempts of campaign finance reform is to stop independent expenditures from affecting the election on the grounds that we don't want rich people to affect the election. So everybody who spends a certain amount of money has to register, and they can't coordinate. Well, first, now they can spend less than the limit, which is $1,000 or $2,000, and still affect an election if their video goes viral. Second, it's obviously speech, so I don't see how the government's going to get away with regulating or even requiring people to register before they put up a YouTube ad. And third, it probably breaks, most subversive, it breaks the whole connection between money and winning the election. You know, it used to be you spend money on TV ads, you put $10 million on TV, you win the election. Now, it's whatever goes viral in
well,
the
yeah,
paradigm.
But it's not as if money can be of no assistance in making. I mean, look, if Pajamas Media decides to make something that has some degree of viral potential actually go viral, they can probably do it if they really call all the people in their network who are kind of on their payroll in some sense.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I know all sorts of people who've tried to go viral. We've tried to go viral. Huffington Post have tried to go viral. Slate tried to go viral. It seems more random than can be bought by money. I guess if you get the best creative minds in your generation and buy them and put them to work on doing something viral, they will eventually come up with it. If you buy the services of the woman who did Obama Girl, she's probably going to come up with something pretty good. But it seems more random than can reliably be bought with money.
Well, that is, it can't reliably be bought with money, but I would say it's not the case that money's of no value either in propagating a meme that's been kind of well packaged. But you're right, I think the interesting thing is the unpredictability, because what it means is, I mean, you know, campaigns are going to continue to do their ads, and they're going to try to do good attack ads, but increasingly I think it's going to be the case that, like, what are the chances that the most viral attack ad will be one actually produced by the campaign, right?
Right.
Increasingly, well, the chances are that the creative juices happen to align somewhere outside of the campaign.
Right.
And so most of the successful attack ads, and in a sense most of the successful advocacy ads, maybe, are going to just come from outside of the campaign.
Well, and the paradigm, you know, this happened in 88 before the Internet when the Willie Horton ad was not an official ad, and it only ran, if it ever ran at all, once.
Yeah.
And it was immediately taken up by the media. Back now, the Willie Horton ad will be made by some private guy in his basement.
Well, as I contended last time, one of those anti-immigration bill ads that was made by Michelle M. Malkin. It was on Hot Air. Was Willie Horton-esque, and it came from informal channels, right?
Well, actually, I like sort of, I on my blog, I said people should make those ads, and
it was a call to arms, and she responded.
No, I think she was actually making them before. But anyway, it produced a handful of ads, some of which were very good. It's not clear to me that they had that much direct effect. They weren't intended to have a direct effect. The Willie Horton ad was seen by people and scared people about Dukakis, right?
Right.
These ads were supposed to be seen by politicians in Washington and scare them about what could be done to them in the next campaign. It was a much more indirect thing. I don't think millions of people saw Michelle's ads and decided to oppose the immigration bill, nor do I think they were that bad. What was so bad about it?
Oh, we had this argument last time, I think.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was about, you know, what was the closing image of an Hispanic guy in, you know, gang tattoos preying on a stereotype in the way that the Willie Horton ad allegedly preyed on a stereotype.
But, okay, we did have that argument.
But another interesting thing is how often or how these ads can backfire. Like, do you think the Obama girl ad was actually good for Obama?
Good question.
I think not. I mean...
Why not? Because
it associates to people to kind of swing voters who have some degree of skepticism of the cultural aura given off by liberals, right? It's exactly what they fear.
Good point. And you think it also?
We'll link to these ads, but if anybody didn't see it, you know, it's a little racy.
It would also explain why Obama's wife seems so pissed off at him all the time.
Oh, that's also kind of part of her shtick. Maureen Dowd wrote a column about this.
I know, but there's been blog speculation completely unfounded as to why she's so angry. But it is a sort of mystery hanging over the
campaign. Do you know that she's really angry, or it's just kind of her shtick is, to roll her eyes, that Obama. Well, that Barack,
She doesn't. Beyond Maureen's point was she does it beyond what is productive for Obama. She seems to be belittling him, and so why does she do this? She must really be pissed off.
That seems to me a natural stick that one could carry too far if one weren't careful.
But I guess that's possible. But it's also possible that she resents all these young things making Obama girl videos about her husband.
Oh, I doubt she was a big fan of that particular video.
Anyway, it does seem to be so I'm finally on board with the John Dickerson YouTube election thing, and it's going to drive the candidates crazy because they're not going to be able to control the process. You know, the subtext of campaign finance reform is candidates want to be the ones in control. They hate these independent ads that may come in at the last minute and screw them up. Now you have millions of people who can make independent ads, all of which are going to be negative. I mean, the positive ones aren't going to have an impact.
And in fact, in his Guardian piece about this whole phenomenon that you steered me to, there was this paragraph. Obama has hired Chris Hughes, the 23-year-old co-founder of the social networking site Facebook, and Edwards has hired so on. And I thought, this paragraph is kind of missing the point of the whole piece in a way. I mean, it's not of no importance who they hire to run their internet operations. But the point, I think, is the one you made. More and more, the important stuff that happens on the Internet is beyond their direct control.
Right. And, one of the issues is, will they try to suppress it somehow through the campaign finance laws? And I think the answer is yes, but it will be shut down.
Well, I agree quickly that the regulation of this stuff will be very problematic in practice.
Life in democracy.
So you also want to talk elsewhere in technology about this? You steered me to this iPhone piece ostensibly the case against the iPhone, but actually the case against the whole genre of technologies that this piece argues are.
I thought it was going to be a terrible piece, and I was going to feel guilty to steer you toward it, but it's actually a pretty well organized piece.
Wow, that's funny because I thought you were going to say sorry about sending you this link. I didn't realize how badly argued it was.
Wasn't badly argued. It
conflated. Horribly argued.
It conflated a couple of issues. One is the issue isn't the erasure of the sphere between public and private. You know, people talking on their cell phones. This guy said that it's basically an argument against cell phone and PDA technology.
Right. And the way, you know, you'll be out in public where there are real human beings, but you're talking on your cell phone or you're emailing or maybe listening to an MP3, which is a little different. But can I read you a paragraph that I think is just ripe for ridicule?
Sure.
From this piece you think highly of?
Sure.
Okay, among the problems with iPhone-like devices, our social fabric is in danger of being ripped to shreds as we swap electronic connection for personal relationships. Well, of course, a lot of the electronic connection is relationship with other people. He goes on to demonstrate that I think he doesn't get that. Okay, the next sentence. The very nature of community depends upon us being connected to one another. Being civil means, or at least used to mean, valuing the relationships beyond our immediate circle of family and friends. Well, these technologies, email and cell phone and so on, are very often used to connect you beyond your circle of family and friends. In fact, one of the things I don't like about them is they lead to more and more contacts of an increasingly superficial nature. The people you're dealing with are really not your friends, and they're not your family.
I don't find that a problem at all. I find that the contacts you have with people who you never would have talked to for 10 years are actually not superficial at all.
Okay.
They're actually quite meaningful. But what he's getting at here is not that it's not that we don't have personal relationships. It's the second life problem. You can go through the world of meat space, and yet you're constantly connected to this virtual world where only you and the people you've chosen are sort of acting, and you sort of ignore what's going on in the actual real world around you. And it does seem to me that has some of the same problems as, you know, the narrow casting problems with the web. And it also has a problem of people being divorced from their actual physical, you know, meat space lives, and it reducing a sort of an element of randomness and geographic community that we're bred by, you know, centuries of evolution to value. And it seems to me you as a Darwinian psychologist should be concerned about the
No, I regret that part. It's kind of an old argument. In fact, I think I made it myself. It just seems to me that this is a particularly bad rendering of the argument, in my view. And there are other examples I could cite. But, I'm sympathetic to the point. And, in fact, today I was going to get my hair cut. And while I was going in, you know, I was in the car listening to an MP3 that I kind of needed to listen to. It was actually a dialogue we haven't posted yet. And I was thinking, would it be bad form to continue to listen to this while getting my hair cut? And I went in, and the person who cut my hair was somebody I'd never seen there before, who had, little in common with me demographically, okay? Black guy, probably 20 years older than me, worked in the post office most of his life, and, you know, I wound up talking to him instead of listening to my MP3, and it was actually a very rich conversation. It was great. It was one of those things you really feel good about.
Well,
it had some
point.
Really great moments.
That's the point.
That is the point, and I appreciate the point. And the irony, by the way, is he used to work in the post office. In fact, there's reason to believe I may have encountered him 20, 25 years ago, given where he was. But it's funny that it used to be with the post office that at least when you use the technology of the day to communicate with people at a distance in non-real time, that is, use the post office, you might encounter an actual human being in the course of, like, mailing your letter, you know, but even that's gone. Who goes to the post office anymore? Anyway, that's an asterisk. But I'm sympathetic.
Did he give you a good haircut?
What?
Did he give you a good haircut? I guess our viewers can
I'm happy with it, but we can vote. They can vote online.
All right, but what were you saying, sorry?
I'm sympathetic, but, you know, you talk about your unstoppable forces. What's going on? Some might argue that the story of history, Mickey, is people, technologies permitting people to play more and more non-zero-sum games with a larger array of people in more different places, and that this is just a continuation of that. And so far, it's been unstoppable.
But at some point, there's going to be a meat space revival. And you can already see it. I mean, in California, we're about to ban talking on the cell phone in your car. So that's a huge chunk of our time out here is going to be recaptured for meat space.
Yeah, but just to get back to, I'm sorry, how shoddy I think this argument is, what he favors is this law about making it illegal to use a cell phone while crossing the street, like in a crosswalk. I mean, I'm sorry, but it seems to me that government intervention should be confined to the kind of thing you just described, where using your cell phone could hurt somebody else.
His point was that it's just not crazy.
I think it is crazy.
Think how guilty the person feels who runs you over.
I think you can also hope for the evolution of etiquette. Like, okay, you're standing in a line, you've got your MP3 player on. The etiquette should probably be you just turn it off. You can get through a transaction at the drugstore without any actual, you know, oral communication, but I would favor an etiquette where you just treat the person like a human while you're dealing with them.
There's one more issue, which is whether which is whether the cell phone versus email. You know, I'm one of the people who I think using the phone at all, even the cell phone or certainly the landline, is now an inefficient waste of time. I hate it. I either use email or I want to see the person in person. I think telephones are a middle ground, and I think there's a bunch of people who think exactly the opposite, who bathe themselves in constant verbal communication via cell phone or landline. And that's a totally separate issue, it seems.
But aren't you often in an email a multi-email transaction where you think, man, this would be simpler if I could just pick up the phone and talk to this person?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Anything that's important and anything involving romance, you have to do over the phone. But
that was a different technological era for me, Mickey. I can't comment on that.
Somebody like you who has so few emotions to play with, email is fine. I mean, somebody with a flat, emotionless affect like you.
Mickey, who has screamed loudest during this dialogue?
I don't know.
Who always screams loudest?
That's true.
Me!
That comes through an email, too. We should move on, because we're, like, taking forever here.
I know, we are. But all that's left is your complaint that your brother and I cast you as a conservative, right?
Well, right. You had my brother on in
and can I just say, Mickey, he's a very likable guy, and I don't mean to sound surprised when I say that.
Your insidious attempt to weasel information out of him about me
was partly successful.
What did you find out, Bob?
Well, he said there had been a confrontation between your mother and Ann Coulter.
There was no confrontation. I was there.
You're calling your brother a liar?
It was an incredibly minor confrontation. They had a very nice meeting, they had like one, you know, argumentative interchange. It was like nothing. The reason I didn't want my brother to talk about it is because it would blow up into something important. It was completely unimportant.
What was it about? What was the argument about?
Pleasant person. Oh, I think Ann told my mother she shouldn't subscribe to Mother Jones. It was like nothing.
Huh.
It was on the way out the door of a perfectly pleasant 10-minute chat. It was, basically nothing happened, and I didn't want my brother to talk about it, A, for privacy concerns, but B, just because it was like nothing.
So all of a sudden, privacy concerns are very important to you, it sounds like.
Well, privacy was the secondary aspect here.
What was the first one?
There was nothing. I didn't want like this to get blown up into something that was.
I'll tell you, lawyers don't throw around the word confrontation lightly, Mickey. And now two of them have. You even used the word.
Did I use the word confrontation? I was just.
You called it minor, I think, a minor confrontation.
Confrontation gets minor enough, it's not.
Well, anyway.
It was not a confrontation in any sense of the firm.
God bless your mother if she cannot get through an encounter with Ann Coulter without a heated exchange. That's all I have to say.
It was certainly not a heated exchange, my God.
I'm glad to hear she had that heated exchange.
It was a small bit of jocular verbal jousting of the sort that anybody who knows Ann Coulter engages with constantly, because that's just one of the joys is that you're constantly arguing with her.
Okay, I'm glad to hear about that heated confrontation.
It was not a heated confrontation.
Beg your pardon?
It was not a heated confrontation.
Can't hear you. Oh, the heated confrontation, yeah. Okay, but your complaint is that Steve and I...
Well, but you and he basically sort of agreed that I was some sort of right-winger, and one of the... I think he said I was pro-torture. Why? How am I pro-torture? I'm like Andrew Sullivan. I'm against torture except in the cases where I'm for it. That's the same with John McCain and Andrew Sullivan.
But you don't think it should be absolutely illegal, right?
Neither does Andrew Sullivan or John McCain are two leading opponents of torture. They both reserve...
Well, apparently your brother and I do, okay?
You would not even torture in the ticking time bomb exception?
I actually subscribe to the views of... And I think for a while this was McCain's view. That, look... I mean, the safest thing to do is just make it strictly illegal. If there ever were a true ticking time bomb scenario, the real one, which, by the way, there will never be, I mean, as these thought experiments are constructed, where it's an atom bomb, it's going to go off and kill a million people. It'll never happen. But if it did happen, we could count on the authorities to break the law and accept the consequences. And we should be able to count on them to do that. and take the risk, and if they lose, be willing to do jail time to save the million lives, okay?
That's
the level of safeguard against the abuse of torture I would like.
That's different. Saying that we hope the law will be broken is different than saying you're against torture in all circumstances.
Saying it should be illegal.
I'm for a law against profiling in airports because I know the authorities are going to break it and profile if necessary. That's the same position.
But, Mickey, our positions are different. I'm saying it should be flat-out illegal. You're saying there should be an explicit loophole in the law.
No, I didn't say that at all. I'm for hypocrisies.
Wait, you're saying it should just be flat-out illegal. The law should only say one thing about torture, illegal in all circumstances. That's your position?
I don't know if I'm for hypocrisy that much. I think we should have a general rule that says we don't torture. Why do we have to go out on a limb and talk about all circumstances? We shouldn't have a situation like Abu Ghraib where we routinely pull low-level people in and torture them, even if that information would be of some incremental value.
Well, it sounds like you don't think it should just be flat-out illegal.
These are all difficult questions as to how much you value hypocrisy, Bob, but you're a hypocrite because you want it flat-out illegal, yet you say the law should be violated. So does McCain. Whether you're for a flat-out law that you think should be violated or carving out an exception and being honest about it seems to me not a major argument that makes one side pro-torture or anti-torture. You're both for torturing people in the ticking time bomb situation.
I contend that you're using...
The fact that I agree with you on that doesn't make me a right-winger and doesn't make me pro-torture. The question is whether you're pro-hypocrisy or not, and I think I am pro-hypocrisy.
I think that's the most you've raised your voice so far. I count that as a success on my part. But I think obviously, by saying what it's really a question of hypocrisy versus honesty is a fairly cheesy rhetorical device, Mickey. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't understand. Why is it cheesy? You're saying you want a blanket exception, yet you know that it's not going to be applied in a blanket way. So why isn't that hypocritical?
Isn't hypocrisy doing something other than what you tell other people to do?
Isn't that what you're doing in this case? It's a homage vice place to virtue. So there
Wait,
you go.
What is it that I'm doing that I'm
you're
telling other people not to do?
You're saying it's illegal, yet you expect the president to disobey the law and go to jail and torture people.
Well, actually, in the real world, I don't, because I don't think the occasion would arise. In the unlikely event that it did, yeah, I would expect him to do that. And I don't know why hypocrisy applies, because in that theoretical scenario, if I were president, I would do it. I would do what I would be advocating in both cases, which is obey the law unless it really is a matter of saving
honest,
a million people in Manhattan.
To be honest, you will proclaim a law. I am against torture in all circumstances. It is illegal, yet I will disobey it. It seems to me...
I don't think what I've done is said is dishonest. I'm being totally open
dishonest.
About what I'm advocating. Cheesy rhetorical device, Mickey. Cheesy, cheesy, cheesy.
Oh, please. Anyway, I'm not pro-torture any more than you are.
Yes, you are. You're not embracing a law that bans it under all circumstances.
Because you say you're not going to enforce that law. You're going to depend on people disobeying the law. So it does seem to me that we both torture people in the exact same number of circumstances.
Well, in closing, let me just say that I think you've admirably advocated your pro-torture position, Mickey.
Sorry?
Nothing.
You're talk about cheesy rhetorical devices.
Little house cleaning, okay?
Okay.
First of all, I hope I'm actually going to be gone next week on a family reunion.
Don't pressure me on air. That's stupid.
I wasn't going to do that.
Okay.
But I will now that you brought it up. What I was going to say was that I hope that in my absence, we will introduce the Flash format, about which I'll talk soon.
Right.
But as long as you brought that up, Mickey,
No, that's not either.
A lot of viewers were asking for a Mickey-Steve dialogue, and, we're in danger. With me being at this family reunion next week, we're in danger for the first time ever of going a whole week without a Bob or a Mickey. And, one solution would be to have your own little kind of family reunion, you and Steve dialogue.
Break my heart. How do you do that?
Okay, we'll talk about it later.
Blogging Heads is your baby.
Okay, we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
We should at least leave them in suspense so that they'll tune in, don't you think?
Yeah, well, there's much more demand for a dialogue with my mother.
I would embrace that.
I can't even get her. I can't even get her technologically advanced enough to watch the damn.
We will
videos.
Send somebody out. I can do it, Mickey. I'm not kidding. You want a dialogue with your mother?
No.
How about her and Steve when they talk about you?
You and Peggy would be good.
I like Peggy.
Peggy's my mother. Okay.
I like the fact that you call her Peggy, too.
I'm not sure she does.
Okay, so anyway, they're on the edge of their seats. They may see Mickey and Steve next week. We don't know.
What's the Flash format?
They almost certainly will see the Flash format.
What is the Flash format?
Well, it's just a different video format, and it allows for some important things like, first of all, embedding, but more immediately, just things like now the Dinglink button will work for everybody regardless of which browser they have. Also, it'll work for Macs without them downloading special software. Much better platform. There are some sacrifices we're having to make. There will only be one high-speed alternative, for example. It'll probably be about 1.3 or something like that. But there are downsides. And also, the player they initially see will be pretty straightforward and visually unspectacular because we're going to wait until the redesign comes out to really show off the really groovy-looking player, you know.
So this is like Blogging Heads 1.5?
It's like Flash 1.0. For us, yeah, and this is not like the redesign, which is still weeks away, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, and when is this happening?
The Flash?
Yeah.
About the time you and Steve show up on the site.
That could
you
be
could
a long
inaugurate
time.
It, if that not could, sooner.
That could be a long time, Bob.
You never know. We'll talk later.
I want to do one with Steve at some point. I just don't know if I can get it together next week.
We'll talk. Yeah. The other thing is, you know, we talked about jobs last time and even posted some. There's also a kind of, I guess what you might call senior level position or something that we will also post. I guess we'll put a link next to this. And this would be for someone with, you know, appreciable experience in journalism. I think we'd be looking for the kind of person who, like, if, God forbid, I died tomorrow, could just kind of take over, you know?
Hmm.
Not
okay.
That's in the plans, but what I mean is, yeah, that's what I mean. Do you have any questions, Mickey?
Like all editors, you're looking for a baby Jesus who can come and do your job so you can concentrate on long-term planning.
Long-term strategic planning, synergy.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, no, it would be a lot of things.
Well, that person may be out there. Who knows?
That may be. It's an interesting job that's not quite like anything that's ever existed, but you'd have to be, on the one hand, be able to write and or edit kind of pithy headlines and so on that are accurate and occasionally lighthearted, and on the other hand, you know, orchestrate dialogues and even think of new creative matches, bring new people in, and so on. It'd be a fascinating job, and it actually pays some money.
It's also possible that that you get somebody with some entrepreneurial energy who would who would just do more to spread Blogging Heads around the world than even you could. Perhaps somebody maybe who's even a better businessman than you are.
I'm open to that.
That's hard to believe.
That's not hard to believe, and I'm open to it.
Well, great.
Just quickly, Mickey, some highlights from commenters.
Yeah.
Carpenter all writes, I say impeach Mickey, replaced by Steven.
There are a lot of comments like that, yeah.
Yeah. Keisha says, replace Kaus with Kaus, please. Lars writes, Stephen Kaus for president. Twin Swords writes, I love Mickey, but his brother is incredible. Twin Swords is a real lefty, so you shouldn't feel offended by that. But then a couple of women like spring to your defense. Stephen Kaus is okay, writes Lily. But I watch Blogging Heads for Mickey Kaus. If you Mickey bashers drive him away, I'm never coming back, and I'm one of your few female viewers. So don't mess with me. Lily, that's a nice name, Mickey.
There you go.
And then Fanghorn, arguably not quite as nice a name, writes, agreed, Lily. And Mickey gets one more female vote from me. So, you know, this is having Steve on was, if nothing else, a good strategy for flushing the Mickey groupies out of the...
Flushing our two female viewers out of the woodwork.
Out of the woodwork.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
Actually, Steve was always the...
The ladies' man?
The ladies' man, yeah.
Was he?
Yeah.
Well, you're the one who's on the market now, buddy.
I was the geek. Anyone got married.
He's in the same predicament I'm in, and you're out there living it up. Any Hollywood parties lately?
Oh, constant Hollywood parties.
No final celebrity sighting you want to cite before we go off the air?
I've had so many celebrity sightings. They all seem to be of a certain generation. I was talking to a very nice wife and mother who turned out to be Mimi Rogers. I thought that was impressive.
Who is Mimi Rogers? Was she in the...
She was Tom Cruise's first wife.
Wow.
She was a sex bot.
A couple wives ago. Hmm.
Anyway, she was very nice. She was born a Scientologist.
Really? That's when it all started with him? Did she convert him or vice versa?
You could find out
she must have converted him.
A lot of it on the web about that. I think she brought him in, but... her relation to the church now, I'm not sure about. Anyway, none of this came up. We were talking about kids.
Okay.
Anyway, you just assume that I'm constantly bathed in a sea of bold-faced names out here.
Sea of what?
Sea of bold-faced names.
I do. You are.
As we all are.
That's what you're doing with all your free time.
Absolutely. So
okay, well, we leave hoping that we will not go a bobless and Mickey-less week next week, but
I might be overcome by the mold that's gestating in that file cabinet over there. You never know.
You never do know. We'll try to hold that off until after next Wednesday.
Okay.
All right.
See you later.
See you around.
Okay.